You might have been developing a product for, I don't know, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you're putting it online. I mean, I just kind of just get scared by the thought. Maybe it's only me, but I think there is room for improvement in regard to specific IT strategies, specifically for cybersecurity and sharing data.
Hello, everyone. I'm Zach Peterson, and welcome to the Altium On Track podcast. Today, I'll be sitting down with Dietrich Beck, CEO of Elmatica, which is now part of the NCAB group, NCAB group. We're going to be talking all things about supply chain, his upcoming presentation at IPC Apex, and some other interesting topics surrounding cybersecurity and compliance. I think it's going to be a very timely talk, also some very interesting insights that this guy has to tell all of us. So I'm excited. Keep watching and have fun listening. Dietrich, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for the very nice introduction, Zachariah.
Absolutely. You can call me Zach too. Everybody tries to go for the full name, but Zach is fine.
Okay.
It's the name I use in videos anyways.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we were talking earlier, you had mentioned that you are presenting a paper at IPC Apex, and I had actually been invited myself, but I feel that someone who is in maybe your position, quite a bit more experience, has a bit more insights to bring to an event like Apex. So I was really interested to hear, you know, a bit more about what your company does, and then also maybe a quick summary of what was going to be in the IPC Apex paper.
Yes, thank you. No, we are actually the world's oldest, what I like to call, broker of PCB, and we were recently acquired by the NCAB group, as you said earlier, or stated the name, and we are securing PCBs for different partners in the PCB supply chain. And that's also what I've been given the honor to have a presentation about, is specifically PCBs in the supply chain, specifically in regard to compliance. Or And compliance can be differentiated into several aspects, but I've specifically focused here on export compliance in relation to PCB, and with the historical background of actually what has happened, why did it happen, and what do I think will happen forward. We all know the, how can I put it, instabilities or challenges we have now in several places around the world, maybe specifically elements like, let's say, Taiwan and Ukraine and so on. So I think compliance is a hotter theme than ever before, at least in the last 20 years.
So yeah. Go ahead.
No, sorry. Please continue. I just keep on talking. It's like putting a dime on a machine, never stops.
Well, I think when most designers hear the word compliance, it's probably things like local environmental regulations. And if they've ever gone through EMC testing, it's going to be like, you know, radiated emissions compliance. So if you're in the US, correct, you have to deal with FCC. If you're in Europe, it's, you know, CISPR, whatever those laws might be. I think that's where everybody's head goes. And, you know, you're talking about a different level of compliance. I mean, to what extent does this have to apply to maybe the regular designer versus, you know, someone who's dealing like with the government or dealing with medical equipment? You know, there are different levels of compliance.
Yes, there is. Specifically, let's, for example, talk about export compliance. It affects absolutely everybody. For example, when let's say you're sitting at home, you're developing something, and these days you've also been allowed to, for example, work from a home office, which is also actually directly affecting export compliance regulations. They've actually had to do some changes or some updates or some extra allowances because of the COVID period. And then you're sitting at home designing, let's say, a PCB for, it might be a communication device, which is going to be used on a tank or at a military base, or if for a federal government, it might be CIA, it might be FBI, it might be Homeland Security, it might be Norwegian authorities, I mean, all kinds of different agencies. Then automatically, when you're doing this, every country has a different view on it. But if it's, let's say, it's in the United States, then quite quickly, it's what I like to say, CUI, controlled unclassified information, unless it can also be classified and other elements. But you should always consider if it goes into defense or used by the government, is it CUI? And if it is, how am I allowed to process that data? How can I share it? And where can I store it? And not least, who can I store it with? And then you're affected by a multitude of different regulations. And it's very important that actually the designers, or I would like to say actually the ones who are deciding to launch a project where you develop either further develop an existing product or a new product, has to keep in mind how will we be affected. And there's all kinds of different regulations. It's actually quite the same in Europe and United States, also because we're NATO countries. But then, for example, you have the military list one, you have the military or the dual use or the military list two, dual use lists, and also a whole variety of different sanctions. So it means that when you develop something, you need to make sure you don't share it with the wrong person, company, that it ends up in, for example, an embargoed country. That will be very potentially bad news.
Yeah, I know that with the government contracting, you know, supply chain or hierarchy here, at least in the U.S., you know, there's a requirement by the U.S. government to have primes actually subcontract out a certain percentage of that work that could include, you know, CUI or even classified information. And so you have to wonder how far down the chain do you have control over and how much supervision is there, how, you know, as you get farther and farther down the chain of, you know, a subcontractor, you know, where does that all fall apart and then create compliance problems?
A very fair and very accurate and good question. First of all, the tier ones, they have good control of what they're doing. And I think a general rule could be the further down you get, the less information you receive.
But is that because they're dealing with the highest value contracts, so they have the most attention?
Yes.
They're most likely to get audited.
Yes, to take a PCB, for example, in a defense project, the value might be 0.001% of the value or even less. It's nothing. So you start, it's a natural, you start with the highest cost elements. I think one should think differently. One should think, what are we addressing which has a drawing? Because automatically, practically, if you have a drawing, like a drawing for PCB, it's CUI. And there's also new regulations coming out in America, which I think will affect Europe greatly in the future, which specifically handles everything which has a drawing. Because if it's drawing, which means it has been developed in that country, it might be a drawing in Norway, it might be a drawing in Sweden, Germany, America. But automatically, when you draw something, and you create something of what your intellectual property rights, then, and it's linked to specifically designed for defense, you should be wary what might the potential export compliance regulations in this case, or what can we be affected by. So you should have some training, and I know that each country handles this in different ways, but there's actually this, most countries actually handle it in the same way, but there's a lack of understanding. I would like to say that since, let's say, the 1993, when the Cold War was over, and then things eased down, even though the same regulations have been there the entire time. And now it's getting more and more focus on this aspect, which we see. Yeah, without going into direct consequences, it's very simple just to search online and you'll find a lot of the, how can I put it, different cases of what has happened.
Yeah, I am going to assume that some of that greater focus on compliance has come kind of from two possible aspects. One is intellectual property theft by actors in East Asian countries. And I think we all know which East Asian country I'm talking about. But then also cybersecurity concerns, because obviously if you have weak cybersecurity, there's the potential for those designs to be exposed, even possibly if you didn't send them to somebody who is outside your country and would be subject to regular export control requirements.
And I think you're touching a very super important subject, and that is how many companies have a strategy in regard to cybersecurity and compliance. Imagine how many who are sending out, let's say you have a product, I'm calling the project X. You're sending it out to 10 different EMSs to get it quoted. I'm not saying anybody's doing anything wrong. But you're sending it out over the web, which means if you know something about sending files, it means it's, for example, it's one file becomes three files, and the first file which reaches tells others who to delete. So do you have an encrypted network? What kind of intellectual property are you sending out? Which means who is actually accessing it, where is it stored, and how afterwards is it deleted? Which means you might have been developing a product for, I don't know, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and you're putting it online. I mean, I just kind of just get scared by the thought. Maybe it's only me, but I think there is room for improvement in regard to specific IT strategies, specifically for cybersecurity and sharing data. And the general rule is don't share it if you don't need to share it. And don't have access to it if you're not using it in your everyday work. I was at the cybersecurity training in Washington a couple of years ago. And I remember it was a lawyer who asked, how many people here have access to the bank accounts? And it was X amount of people who had it. And he said, how many people actually need access to it? And none of them needed. And then he asked, why do you have access? You know, sometimes it's like in a company, the higher up you get, you should have more and more accesses. I think that is completely wrong. I think you should have access to what you need to have access to, and then you're allowed to ask your colleagues for documentation or papers, whatever, for the other things you might need for a specific case. So starting locking down each company and being much more aware of who has access and where it's stored, I think that's a great place to start. Also, if I remember in 2017 and 2019, I think somewhere between 50 and 60% of, for example, American companies had multi-factor authentication, which means if you don't have that, people can practically at any time, I mean, this costs nothing. It's a standard feature in Google and most other systems, log on to your company and actually just steal your data. So sitting down on the officer level in each and every company, irrespective of how big it is, it can be one employee or 100 or 1,000 for that sake, putting down some very quick instructions what to do and not to do is great. And there's also so much new software now, without saving names of softwares, but a lot of specifically American softwares, I can put it that way, also on the stock exchange in America, which have made the cybersecurity setup and structure and control much easier than it was only 3, 5, 10 years ago, which means we're talking about standardized systems off the shelf, buying it, implementing it. In the past, you needed your own IT man or woman to set it up and secure it. Now, practically every mom and dad shop can do it also. It's just a matter of focus and also at a very affordable price.
Yeah, I mean, in a way that's encouraging, you know, the fact that it can be in some way standardized and I guess easy to access and easy to get to make yourself compliant. But, you know, I wonder how many companies actually do this, you know, even if they don't know they're actually dealing with export control data because nobody tells them. And so whoever they're dealing with expects them to know. I mean, when my company receives a design, we're told this is export control data. So, and we receive it through a channel that we know is meant to pass export control data to us. So it's very clear and open, and we have to prove compliance in that way. And, you know, obviously we can't just go emailing around stuff if we have to send files around. But I, you know, like a mom and pop shop who may not have a huge budget, number one, are they even implementing it? And two, if they're not, do they even know about it? Because it seems like the IT strategy at some point starts to diverge from the compliance strategy. And so, you know, how do you get those two to come back together and get implemented together? Because it clearly they go together.
Yes, that's a very good question. Also, a quite challenging question. Let's say you have, I'm just giving some numbers, let's say $10 million per year in revenue and the defense or export compliant. There might be also other things. It could be a medical project, other things which requires a whole different level, or telecommunication, which is actually quite close to defense. You have like, let's say 10% of your business. And then who knows, the margins might be high, the margin might be low. And the question is, how much are you willing to invest? So I think it actually boils down to a strategic choice. It's thinking, do I want to stay in this business and grow or not? But I could say on a general level, which I'm also presenting at IPC, is that this market is quite huge, and I think it's only going to grow actually quite dramatically over the years to come. So those who decide to have a concrete strategy and actually implement measurements to be compliant will, not in a short run, but maybe in, let's say, 2 to 5 years going forward, they will reap some very nice potential benefits of this, I would call or say, relatively small investment at this time.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think companies should be looking out, you know, in that 2 to 5 year time frame for these types of investments. For, you know, just as you said, it's not like it's a huge investment, but number two, as the market grows, it's going to need more of these types of measures to ensure compliance and security.
And we've seen, without going into detail, some governments, also United States government, which are looking into more and more of everything they're buying, which is specifically for surveillance, telecommunication, and so on, which has a lot of PCBs. Where is it produced? Who has access to it? Should we bring it back to American soil? Can we buy it from our partners in Europe? It's a lot of things going on. We are a part of a lot of discussions where we hear what things people are thinking. And what I can say, people need to start to prepare. If you wait 2-3 years, you might suddenly be out of that business and that potential growth also. So, you know, making some contacts, and you don't need too fancy, expensive lawyers. You can gain a lot from just starting reading on the net and making some and choosing some very good standardized system. It can be with Azure Cloud, it can be CrowdStrike, it can be Sentinel, all kinds of systems which will help you significantly very quick. And depends what kind of data you're handling. But if you're not handling the most secure data, you can have some very good standardized solutions to what I would say an affordable price. But it takes, I would say it's more like a strategic focus, and not least talking to your colleagues and being more careful. I mean, if you receive something that looks fishy, don't open it. It's very simple. You know, 80% of breaches are people, and we're all people, which open or look into stuff they shouldn't look into. Just, you know, awareness, talking about it. Like, if you get something suspicious, don't respond back to the email. Hey, is this you? You know, the phone is an unused medium. I like to say that, you know, to write an excellent email, it can take me anywhere from 30 minutes to 2-3 hours. But if I call the person, I'll handle it in 3 minutes. And afterwards, I can just, you know, write a short summary. We agree to the following. So I'm a little bit old school. Call me.
Yeah, I can't tell you the number of emails I get every day with some strange file attached. Yeah. Hey, look, hey, here's your invoice. Check it out. Or, you know, here's this crazy image that someone wants to send you. Or here's an HTML file. And I mean, it's kind of obvious at this point what people are trying to do. And, yes. You know, I mean, my company is a small company. I'm not Boeing or anything, but you have to wonder, like, how many of those phishing emails do larger companies get? And it almost seems like it's statistically guaranteed at some point for somebody to try and open something that they shouldn't be opening. And then there's a data breach.
I think also that's why they're doing it, because if nobody had opened it, then they would have stopped sending it.
That's a great point.
So instead of spending huge money on systems and sandbox systems and filter systems, why not spend a couple of dollars on that good coffee and talking to your colleagues and saying, you know, if it looks fishy, it probably smells bad. You know, don't jump into the water, call somebody. You know, we're talking low tech, which is just using our brains.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's so funny, because you're right. If it didn't work, people wouldn't continue to do it. It's like the Nigerian print scam, you know,
yes.
Like, which you thought would have gone away, right?
Yeah. but that's, I mean, and of course, in a workday when people are stressed and have a lot to do, you might get that email just before a meeting and you don't think. So it's just, again, repetitive training. And like we do at our company, we have our own IT sending us different kinds of emails and doing standardized off-the-shelf systems you can buy, where you do training, they send you emails, they test you and see how you're responding. So it's just awareness at a low cost. I know everybody screams when it's something new, oh, this is the cost. But I would rather say, what is the cost of you losing control of your products? What is the cost of somebody in X country making a simple rip-off copy of your products and selling it? That cost is tremendous. So I say spending some money as precaution is worth every single dime.
Well, I mean, when you say the cost is tremendous, I mean, can you make that more tangible? Because when people think like IP theft, I think it is... Because it's hard to make it tangible, it seems like it's this far-off, isolated thing that, you know, maybe a few large companies have to worry about. But I think if you look under the surface and you think about how often data breaches happen, it's probably a lot more common than people realize.
Without going into the specific details, I can give some general examples. And I know from one of our partners, they said that every time they launch a new product, they're quite big. It takes 18 months on average before that product is copied and on the market. 18 months. And they can have spent, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars to develop it, for that sake. So they've had a strategy, for example, that when it comes to software, they develop the software in one specific country. And if they produce in other countries, then the software is only, they don't send the software, put it that way. It's uploaded directly into their devices when it's sent back to their country. So that means that they might copy the physical attributes of the product, but they will not be able to access the software in the same respect. And of course, they put all kinds of measurements in, so they can. So it's also a challenge to access the software afterwards. So I think having the bigger you get, having specific strategies might be very smart. And choosing some partners which you trust is always a good rule. You know, people like to jump around for prices, which I think is a quite big challenge these days, as all the prices are going the wrong way, which means up, practically all at least. I mean, I don't understand how this inflation is calculated, if you ask me, but that's a different story, I guess, a different debate, actually. But you should think about, it's not, you know, find some good people you can work with, which you trust, have some good routines, and trust in your products, and you will most likely be successful.
Yeah, well, you and I can save the inflation debate for another episode of the podcast if you want. But this seems like it's interesting because you say, you know, it only takes 18 months to make a full copy. I mean, I think this relates a bit to something that we had talked about in a previous podcast with Joe Grand, who's well known as a hardware hacker. And we'll actually link to that in the show notes. But, you know, he had talked a lot about security through obfuscation. Essentially, just all you can really do is try and make it harder for someone to copy the product. And that's what it seems like when, you know, this partner that you're referencing is doing. They're essentially forcing you, they're putting up as many barriers as they can to prevent intellectual property theft. I mean, is that all people can do? I mean, aside from, you know, knowing who you're giving something to, but I mean, at some point down the chain, it's going to get exposed to somebody who probably shouldn't see it. And so what else can companies do to help guarantee compliance and prevent this kind of copying? And I mean, how far does that copying go? I mean, are the products identical? Is it just like, you know, they have this product, it's copied, they just slap a new label on it and then, you know, act like it's authentic?
Yeah, I do know a lot of stories. I'm not at liberty to convey, but yes, it is a challenge. You can, of course, have patents and so on. Not everything can be patented. I think that the best security is working with people who has the same degree of security as you have. And it's quite seldom, I mean, it's actually super rare that I am confronted with people like, hey, I would like you to present your cybersecurity strategy. I would like you to present your export compliance strategy. I would like to know how your database structure is. These questions should be general questions. How is your customer screening? How is your partner screening? I mean, these questions are lacking. So I'm hoping that all those who do audits and so on start asking more questions and more interesting questions than, without being disrespectful, sometimes, where is your fire extinguisher? You know, it's quite seldom houses are burning these days. Of course, that's not good if anything burns, but there are other questions which should be added to the audits which are conducted in all kinds of countries, but in all kinds of industries. Start with cybersecurity. What are you doing? I think people will be, how can I put it, surprised.
So if, you know, a smaller design firm is looking to get into a market that requires a high level of compliance, you know, you brought up some software solutions that can help ensure compliance. But aside from implementing those types of solutions, you know, it sounds like you're expecting some of those audit requests to get a bit deeper and that these smaller firms should really prepare to be answering those questions for larger clients, especially if they are working in something like defense and aerospace. Would you say that's correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So that could be, that could involve anything from, you know, developing formalized, you know, packages that they can send out when they get an audit request that really proves this type of compliance. I mean, how deep does that have to go? You know, you brought up like, what's your database structure?
Yes. In America, you have, of course, you have the FAR and the DFAR, Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement. You also have the ITAR, which is when you're exporting it. Every single country, and in Germany, you have the BAFA, which regulates. In England, so you can have open general license. And you have a State Department in Norway and Sweden. And all countries have different regulations. But they're built kind of the same, I would say, in the same way. And by far the American government has come the furthest, and not least with some of the plans I've seen for the future. For example, you have the NIST 800-171B, which is applicable automatically under the DFARS, which has 110 controls, if I remember correctly, regarding what you're supposed to do. So it's there are a lot of requirements out there. So you need to sit down and read a little bit. And there are specific requirements regarding defense compliance. I think the best thing would be actually if some of the countries, specifically the NATO countries, agree to some kind of standard set of requirements. That would have been great for all the rest of us. And also, since a lot of these regulations were made in the, let's say, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we didn't have internet at that time, put it that way. So not everything is made for the future. So I know that there's some groundbreaking work being done there in many countries, both on both sides of the Atlantic, which I think in the near future will help and make it easier for all the actors to understand what to do. Because there are some conflicting views upon storage and how you do stuff. So I'm looking forward, and since you're very small, also like us, we are just trying to, you know, do what we're being told to do and understand the regulations. Sometimes it can be a challenge, but again, you can do a lot with simple tools, which standardized tools off the shelf to protect your company and protect the data. So I think it's important to show that you're, you're not sitting and waiting for somebody to knock on the door. You have to be proactive. It might not be perfect, but at least you have a strategy and working on it. And that's often very, people are usually very understanding.
Sure, sure. And I mean, it seems like a lot of these efforts around compliance and cybersecurity, like they're just getting pawned off onto a third party that you now have to trust. So whether it's, you know, just your antivirus program or whether it is something more advanced, some of those other companies that you mentioned earlier, it seems like, you know, there's going to be some level of compliance that you're going to have to trust that they can help you satisfy.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be your internal practices and processes that you then have to implement yourself.
Yes.
And I mean, how do you, is it going to be as simple as, you know, if you get asked to prove compliance by a large, in order to, you know, win a large contract, let's say, you just say, hey, I have CrowdStrike. And that satisfies, you know, 18 points on the checklist.
No, it's as I say, under the NIST, it's quite specific requirements. This is different from country to country. I'm talking more on a general level now. The American regulations are quite specific. But of course, if you have a tier one, which have not informed you about the mandatory flow down clauses in DFARS, and you don't know, that's a challenge, which means everybody needs to inform. We need to have openness in the PCB supply chain regarding the compliance regulations, which affects you. And since a lot of defense projects, let's say, for example, the F-35, that's, you know, developed United States, but it's also a lot of cross-development in countries like Denmark, Norway, for example, the TX, which is the fighter trainer for the F-35, is from Sweden, from Saab and so on. So a lot of actors are working together, which means multiple of compliance sets are applicable, and which might be a little bit different. But again, as long as you have a strategy and working on it and being and implementing measurements, specifically for European countries, I think you're already on a good path.
Yeah, and I don't have clients in Europe, but I do have clients in Canada that work in the defense industry. And between the U.S. and Canada, there's actually a joint certification program where you can get approval to get this technical data from both sides. Because you have to, you know, you have to go through this vetting process. Is there actually something similar between the U.S. and Europe?
No, between the U.S. and Europe, it's the, I know there's some special projects, for example, between England and the United States, but it's mainly if it's developed in the United States and sent to Europe, it's ITAR. If we develop it here and it's purchased by the United States government, then it's the DFAR. Quite simple. I mean, that's, and of course, yeah, that's the easiest way to put it. But there's, at the same time, every country has different regulations regarding embargo countries and also people and companies and also where you're allowed to produce, for example, that can differentiate. So it might be, for example, that the one country accepts another country for production or sales or end use, but another does not. So depending on where you have produced the PCB, might actually the consequence might be suddenly that you cannot sell that rocket because the PCB was made in a country which doesn't accept sales to that country. So again, you need to have a strategy. And then I've learned once that, for example, if it's a PCB for a plane, just to do a test to see after to, you know, to change the PCB would cost, let's say, about $1.2 million for test flight. So if you saved $5 on that PCB, that was very expensive. So you, again, have a strategy from the beginning. And make sure that the designers, when they're sitting there, that they know, they should know where we're planning to sell this product, because that will automatically affect where they can produce. And also, for example, I would say that the laminate is the lowest level on the PCB. Make sure you know which country that laminate is coming from, because that might be also an embargoed country or somebody you do not have a defense alliance with, or place you don't want the laminate to come from due to different kinds of reasons.
Yeah, you brought up something interesting, which is, you know, suppose I export to one country to a subcontractor and I don't check where they're going to then produce, and they go to another country to do some work or to produce, and that third country is now embargoed by my country. Yes. I had not initially considered that, but I think that makes total sense. You have to have that strategy in place when you're dealing with subcontractors.
Yes. So that's why you put it simple. You need to know country of origin for every single article you have in your products.
Yeah,
that does not mean where you're buying it. It's, that doesn't matter. Where is it produced?
Yes.
And then that should be in very simple and good old-fashioned Excel. Still works great.
The wonders of Excel. Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, this is really interesting. And I mean, I'm so happy that you've come on to talk about this, because I think that this is one of those areas where a lot of designers, you know, like you kind of mentioned at the beginning, think they're going to have to hire a lawyer, and it's just something that you put off and put off and put off. Or maybe you just try and Google all the answers. And I think it could create some compliance hazards for certain designers. And I'm wondering, you know, how many companies think they're compliant because of this, but they really aren't compliant? And how much of a risk is that?
That's a very, it's difficult for me to answer, but I've been to some, for example, defense last time at Arlington Cemetery, was listening to Katie Arrington, and I think there's, she didn't say anything specifically about this, but I think there's room for improvement. And that's also why you're implementing new regulations, like, for example, the CMMC, which is coming out, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certificate, a very long name, even for a Norwegian to pronounce. I think we're doing stuff to help the industry, and also where industry is an active actor. But it's a challenge for many.
It sounds like what you're saying is that if you were to pick a given defense contractor at random, there is a high probability that they could do more without naming anybody specifically.
I think that's also what the CMMC is about. It's about you will never be good enough. You will have to have a continuous focus on improvement, kind of like when you have an ISO. You will never reach the goal. Once you reach the goal, you'll just move the goal forward, but it's a continuous process where we cannot afford to stop. So once you think that you're great at cybersecurity, okay, what can we do better? Of course, not take it to a unnecessary high level according to the information you have, but it's a never-ending process. And I'm not the judge, and I'm not qualified to judge how others are handling it, but I do believe there's room for improvement, and I think a good place to start is communicating more with each other, specifically in the supply chain, and making sure that if you have received demands from your tier one, for example, or the product owner or the purchasing entity, make sure that the information is passed along, and remember that you have a sole responsibility. So if you don't have any process or vetting or anything, then it might be a little bit challenging for you afterwards. So make sure that, you know, okay, ask some questions, document it. You know, what is this for? Is this for defense? Is this for medical? Is this for telecommunication? Ask some questions. Start gathering data, and show that you are continuously, you know, working with it and trying to improve. Letting it lie on the side and think everything is going to be fine, I do not think that's the best or wisest strategy to choose.
Yeah, I like what you said about that, gathering some data ahead of time and, you know, at least knowing kind of broadly what the end application is going to be. I've been involved in projects where they don't really tell you exactly what it's going to be. They you know, you get the technical data and you have a board that you're working, but you don't necessarily know what it's going to be used in until you've worked with the company for a few years. And, you know, over the course of those few years, you get little tidbits of information from emails, and you learn a little bit about what the company does, and then you kind of connect the dots and realize, oh, that's what I'm working on. I should have probably been a little more careful with who I'm sharing this data with, or something like this.
Yes, but sometimes people have the wrong misconception about the sharing data. They think if I don't say what it's about, then I keep it, then that's good. Actually, that's a risk, because sure, you need to share that to your partner so they actually know, so they could say, oh, I understand, we are not, we don't have the capability to receive this data and keep it secure, so you have to go to somebody else. Or they could say that, hey, that's very interesting, I looked up, I need to buy a new system to handle this kind of data, could you please give me a week and I'll fix it. So again, sharing is caring, but keeping it secret is actually putting everybody at the risk. Imagine having an audit and they're like, yeah, so what did you inform company X about? No, we didn't inform them. What? You didn't inform them? How can they know? But it's also the responsibility of the company receiving the information, having some documentation that you've asked at least some questions. I mean, if you go to the web page and you only see pictures of rockets and like, oh, I didn't know they worked in defense, you might have a small challenge there too. So it's not like they didn't tell me, or I would like to say plausible deniability does not count. You need to do something, and you need to show that you are improving or working with it. I'm not a judge here again, but I think I strongly advise people to have a strategy and work on it.
Yeah, it seems like just saying this is export controlled is almost the bare minimum in information that you're giving, yes, right? I mean, if you're a firm that, you know, generally works on that type of project, I think you're a little more prepared to deal with that when it comes up. But if they don't tell you that and they don't tell you what it's going to go in, then I would agree with you. I think that the top level contractor is actually creating a new risk just by not telling someone to not share something. Yes. Essentially assuming like it should be obvious, they should know not to share this.
Yes. And it's also been a tremendous price pressure for many, many years. And then back to the inflation discussion almost. You're not always saving money. Yeah, you have to look at the total costs, not necessarily the price. So being aware of the potential consequences of this, and it's, as I say again, it's just go online and search and you'll see some tremendous fines. I know one company not long ago got a fine for $30 million for not handling the information properly. That will affect not all companies, but a lot of the companies I know. And remember that most companies are usually quite small. So $30 million, that's expensive.
Yeah, especially when you start to consider how much of the contracting budgets, at least in the US, are statutorily required to be subbed out to small businesses.
Yeah.
That's a lot for those subcontractors.
But I also think that large subcontractors could be, there's an improvement in respect to having more gatherings where they invite all the small subcontractors. So it could be by Zoom these days and saying, we'd like to give you a course on compliance. When you receive information from us, these are systems we recommend you should consider. they're quite inexpensive and good, and reach, for example, FedRAMP approved server system and so on. We advise you to look into these things. You know, again, sharing more, not keeping it a secret. That's keeping a secret is keeping a danger. Talking to your partner is securing your supply chain. Very simple.
You know, those are really excellent points, especially putting some of that responsibility back on the prime contractor to really help secure their subcontractors and prevent fines from traveling up the chain all the way to potentially to them. So I think you're really hitting an important point of reliability. I'm wondering when some of those costs for data breaches, IP security, are really going to be priced in to what defense contractors do, because it is a risk. And those risks have to be priced into what they do. But this seems like a really simple way for them to reduce that risk and be more competitive, especially when they're, you know, when more regulation comes down that is going to place more requirements on not just the subs, but also the primes.
Yeah, that's why it's one of the beauties of the DFI regulation, for example, it's mandatory flow downs. So it's not like, I don't know how many discussions I've been to where people say, oh, it's a mandatory flow down week, but we'll discuss and try to get this away. And so was at one training in the United States regarding this and FAR. This is non-negotiable. I mean, if you want to make a bid on the contract, these are the clause. So either take it or leave it. Don't spend time waste on trying to get away from it. This is what they want, and you have to deliver, or you cannot quote. So that's, you know, read the papers, and they're quite well written. I think the United States have come very far when it comes to giving out the proper information regarding what they expect. It's not perfect, and it's sometimes can be a challenge, put it that way, but it's compared to other countries, I think we have, we can learn a lot from you.
Well, it sounds like I'm going to have to review what's in my DFARS report, because I've just had a lawyer prepare it and I never read it, to be honest. They give me the questionnaire, I fill it out, they prepare it, and we call it a day.
Yeah. You should know it. And there's also some great courses. If you have federal publication seminars in FPS in the United States, they have seminars all the time. All kinds of seminars you can go to. I'm just mentioning that because I happened to be there once. So there are possibilities to learn if you want to, and train everybody. Send one person, let that person come back and train everybody. Implement simple routines, talk together, you know, spend that time on that coffee, and then most likely you will be. Perhaps not perfect, but on the way towards perfection.
Absolutely. Well, Dietrich, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an extremely enlightening conversation, not just for me, but I hope also for all the listeners out there. Dietrich, thank you so much again for joining us. Hope to have you back later.
Thank you, Zach. It was a pleasure being here, and look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you so much. And to all the listeners out there, don't stop learning, stay on track, and thanks, everybody.